Hello, and welcome back to Climate Changes Everything. This is Episode 10, Ancient Solar Energy, Part 6, cheeky subtitle, Green Eggs and Ham. Unusually, this episode has a special guest, background noise. As I'm on the road this week and can't seem to completely shut off the fan in my hotel room, I'll try to fix that with some software wizardry. And never fear, I'll be back in Studio L, aka the much quieter laundry room in my house, very soon. Over the last few episodes, we've been drilling down deep on natural gas, focusing on where it comes from, its twisty-turny history as a fuel, and the major challenges and opportunities of its production, from fracking and horizontal drilling to environmental harm like water contamination, public safety risks like seismic events, and climate changers like methane leaks. So we ended last episode with some serious, multifaceted, and climate-pivotal apprehensions about natural gas in general, including the usually unquestioned climate superiority of natural gas as compared to coal. Too close to coal, at best, but eyes wide, wide, wide open, very much a black and not a white or even gray hat. Which is not the conclusion the world wants to reach, given the pervasive use of natural gas in our world for heating and cooking, for vital manufacturing processes like fertilizers and plastics, and for power generation, our focus here. With all that as prelude, let's make power with the stuff and see if that black hat gets a little more gray, at least. In other words, knowing that all energy is compromise, how do the negatives inherent in natural gas-fueled power generation compare to the positives? Not just at the burn, but considering the entire life cycle of the fuel. As you've probably guessed, that is a wonderfully complex question, or more accurately, set of questions, and rabbit holes, and chutes and ladders, and even green eggs and ham. Green eggs and ham? Now you're dragging Dr. Seuss into this? Indeed I am, Sam I am. You see, when it comes to making electricity with natural gas, I can make it in a boiler, I can make it in a reciprocating engine, I can make it in a combustion turbine, I can make it into steam. Okay, there's no way I'm going to rhyme any of this. How about I can make it into thermal energy, I can make it into mechanical energy? No, sorry, Doc, I tried. But the theme holds. Once we can get natural gas to a power plant, we can convert it into electricity in all sorts of machines, coming in all sorts of sizes, to play all sorts of roles in the power system. But will we end up liking natural gas by the end, like Sam's epiphany at the end of Green Eggs and Ham? Well, here we go. First, the basics. As you may have noticed from our discussion of coal-fired power plants, the conversion of a fossil fuel, coal or natural gas, into electricity is a multi-step process. And a really interesting one, as we trade off a little of that energy with every step, even as every step provides us with more and more options for the next step, and thus the end result. Wonky, but important. And I'll unpack that as we go along. We start, of course, with natural gas, which is the chemical remainder of that stored sunlight, that stored solar energy, from hundreds of millions of years ago. That energy isn't useful to us for power generation in its chemical form, though. We need to convert it into a more useful form. Or, in most cases, from its least useful form, chemical, to a more useful form, thermal, to an even more useful form, mechanical, and then to an incredibly useful form, electricity. Let's start that journey of conversion and see where it leads. Now, with the small exception of fuel cells, which we'll discuss in a later episode, we really have one good option for that more useful form, making heat. That conversion is familiar to anyone who has ever lit a fire. Remember that cave in South Africa about 2 million years ago? Those early hominids figured it out. Expose wood to flame, and the stored sunlight, the chemical energy in the wood, is converted into heat. Same for the more recent ancients, with oil and natural gas. The Persians, Greeks, and Chinese we talked about a few episodes back. And perhaps the gas stove, or furnace, or water heater, or gasoline-powered automobile in your own life. Burning chemical energy converts it into heat. That's a pretty neat trick, and one that has been a defining advantage of our species ever since. Hooray, hominids! So now we have heat, thermal energy. Great, but that's not electricity. Time for the next conversion. Now, instead of the one option we had with chemical energy, we now have two options for converting thermal energy, that heat, into something even more useful. Those two options are mechanical energy and an even more advanced form of thermal energy known as steam. The mechanical option may be more familiar. It's the same thing our gasoline or diesel-powered automobiles do with gasoline or diesel. Combust it and use the expanding air resulting from the heat to push on something and make it move. The technical term is motive power, but I like oomph, one of the many non-technical but equally descriptive terms to describe what's going on. Motive power, that oomph, needs somewhere to go and will push with all its might to get there. In this example, that somewhere is the inside of a steam turbine, basically a tunnel with a rotating shaft inside covered with propeller-like blades. The steam hits those blades, the pressure on the blades turns the shaft to create mechanical energy, and then the real magic happens. The other end of that rotating shaft is connected to a generator, which is a machine that converts mechanical energy, the turning of the shaft, into electric power, exploiting the amazing relationship between magnetism and electricity. Voila, one way to make electricity from natural gas, very similar to what we saw in the coal-fired power plant, with the exception that the coal is turned into steam in a boiler and not in the turbine itself. That's called simple cycle, or more descriptively, single cycle power generation. To distill that down, gas goes into a turbine, gets combusted, turns the blades, and then which then turns the turbine's drive shaft and the generator to produce electricity. The combustion turbine, though, can only convert about a third of the heat into electricity, which means that a full two-thirds of that energy is wasted into the air through a big exhaust pipe, aka a smokestack. Only slightly better than your car. Ouch. Despite its relative inefficiency, simple cycle power generation is in fact relatively simple, and despite its inefficiency, is a key position player in the power grid, as we'll discuss soon. With that, I want to take a quick pause to add two more concepts, a little bit more of basic power generation lingo, some of which I realize I've already used without really defining. You may be familiar with the term internal combustion from the world of automobiles or trucks or airplanes. The engine is designed for the fuel to be combusted inside of it. In the power generation world, that's a combustion turbine, an internal combustion turbine. By way of contrast, you may recall the turbines we saw in coal-fired power plants. No combustion inside the turbine, just steam being piped in and the oomph of that steam turning the blades. That's a steam turbine, an external combustion turbine, if you will. the motive force is created outside, not inside of, the machine. Combustion turbines and steam turbines, one internal combustion and the other external combustion. Now back to our conversion journey. I mentioned two options for that chemical to mechanical conversion. The mechanical option we just talked about and a thermal option. The thermal option is a bit more complex, both in how it works and the greater number of subsequent options that it provides. How does it work? Well, instead of using heat to make something move, the chemical to mechanical conversion we just talked about, we use the heat to convert water into steam. Steam has a lot of oomph. It powered the factories of the Industrial Revolution, after all. With steam, our options expand further. In a standard power plant, we can run that steam through a steam turbine to turn a generator and thus convert thermal energy into mechanical energy into electricity. There's a variation of that called cogeneration, where we run some of the steam through a generator to make electricity, but divert some of it for space or water heating or industrial processes. Very common in industrial settings that need both electricity and steam to make whatever they're making. Is your head spinning like a turbine yet? Is it, Sam, I am? Well, one more layer of necessary complexity. Things get really interesting when we combine the mechanical and the thermal, both a combustion turbine and a steam turbine, both internal and external combustion. This is, helpfully enough, called combined cycle. Combining a combustion turbine and a steam turbine in a multi-step use of the same chemical, natural gas, as an input. Green eggs and ham indeed. Here's how that goes. Start with the simple cycle setup we described earlier. Natural gas going into a combustion turbine, which turns a generator to make electricity. In round numbers, about one-third power generation and two-thirds waste heat. As you can imagine, this inefficiency, all that wasted heat going up the stack, has bugged the heck out of power plant engineers for a long time. Wait a minute, what if instead of sending that waste heat up the stack, we use it to make steam and then run the steam through a steam turbine and use that to turn another generator to make more electricity? Well, I'm glad you asked. That's basically how a combined cycle power plant works. And instead of 30% or so efficient, a modern combined cycle plant is 50 to 60% efficient, about twice that of a simple cycle plant. More complex, more efficient, more electricity from the same amount of natural gas. And thus, more electricity from the same amount of fracking, water pollution, seismic disturbances, and leaked methane. Traditionally, a simple cycle plant is the sports car of the power generation world. Smaller, not very efficient, but it can start, accelerate, and brake on a dime. For example, this makes them particularly good at what is called renewable integration, balancing out intermittent renewable generation like wind and solar in the power grid. Especially as the great hope of renewable integration, utility-scale energy storage, is still in the early stages of development and deployment. Combined cycle plants, by contrast, have long been the long-haul truck, big, efficient, but not particularly agile or flexible. Just to complete the analogy, a coal-fired power plant, or nuclear plant for that matter, are the freight trains of the system. Huge, super efficient, but very little agility or flexibility. These analogies and the roles that they represent in the modern power grid are not hard and fast, though. Simple cycle machines are getting bigger and more efficient, even as they retain a lot of agility and flexibility. Conversely, combined cycle machines are getting even more agile and flexible. At the same time, cogeneration is slowly succumbing to environmental pressures associated with the new use of natural gas as a fuel, although more quickly in some political environments, like California, than others. Other big changes are underway too. The big turbine manufacturers, like General Electric in the US, Siemens in Germany, Mitsubishi in Japan, for example, are aggressively re-engineering their machines to burn mixtures of natural gas and hydrogen, with a view to hydrogen eventually replacing natural gas as their primary fuel. The hydrogen movement, in turn, is increasingly focused on what is called green hydrogen, with the word green denoting hydrogen production using greenhouse gas-free electricity. We'll do a deep dive on hydrogen in general and green hydrogen in particular in future episodes. But back to our natural gas-fired power plants. As we've touched on here, and we'll see in upcoming episodes, these various kinds of natural gas-fired power plants play diverse and important roles in today's power system. But what else should we be thinking about? Eyes wide, wide, wide open as we look at these particular versions of ancient solar energy through the lens of all energy is compromised. For me, it comes down to three things. Location, location, location. Okay, that's just one thing, but it's important. And all three of our hats, white, gray, and black. On the positive side, natural gas power plants have greater siting flexibility than most other forms of power generation. In other words, smaller footprints, less viewscape impact than a coal or hydroelectric or solar or wind facility, they can be more easily placed where they're needed on the grid. Not easily, mind you, but more easily. Nearer to big demand centers like cities, for example. And at the larger scale, they bring the usual benefits of big industrial facilities. Local economic benefits like jobs, taxes, and associated commerce, but also the environmental justice concerns of air pollution, noise pollution, and lower property values. Combine these benefits and costs with the benefits and costs across the natural gas value chain, and it begs the question, white hat, black hat, or gray hat? For me, the short answer is all of the above. With, in my mind, a near-term loudspeaker call for methane leak abatement, a medium-term need for the many vital roles that gas plays in the power system, and a longer-term hope for a green hydrogen transformation. Call it green hydrogen and ham, perhaps. With myriad opportunities for innovation, entrepreneurship, and advocacy. Maybe we'll like that one better, or at least with less equivocation. And as always, eyes wide, wide, wide open. In the meantime, we've done 6 full episodes on ancient solar energy, stored sunlight. Many more than I expected, to be honest, and we only covered the solid kind, coal, and the gaseous kind, methane, aka natural gas. As we've seen, there's a lot of necessary complexity here, and necessary for a eyes wide, wide, wide open view of these seemingly simple, ubiquitous fuels. That leaves the liquid form of ancient solar energy, oil. In the US, we tend to associate oil with transportation, gasoline or diesel fuel, but it's a power generation fuel too. Oil has been largely displaced by natural gas in many power systems, but it's still an important niche player, more so where oil is abundant and or coal and natural gas are scarce and expensive. Black gold, Texas tea, or who killed JR, or maybe some other corny analogy. I'll see you soon for another episode of Climate Changes Everything. Thanks for listening.